This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Mary Beth Gianni. This week reading Storytime Magazine, the February issue. Our first story is a famous fable. It's called The Eagle and the Wren. From his perch high on a cliff, the golden eagle stared out across the ocean. It was a cold winter's day, and the sky was clear. Below, the waves of the North Atlantic crashed against the rocky shores of Scotland's Western Isles. The fierce wind ruffled the great bird's feathers. He felt strong and powerful as he peered at the sea far below. "I'm definitely the most kingly bird in the world," he said to himself. "Oh yeah? What makes you so great?" The eagle looked around in confusion. Who dared to question him? He spotted a little bird with speckled brown feathers sheltering in the grass on the cliff top. She was a tiny insect eater called a wren. "I'm so much better than you," boasted the eagle as he stretched. "Look how big my wings are." The wren yawned. "They're pretty big. So what?" The eagle wasn't used to being talked to so cheekily. Finally, he replied, "I can fly higher than any other bird. That's why I am the king of the skies." "Is that so?" chirped the wren. "Why don't we have a contest? The one who can fly the highest will become the ruler of all the birds." By this time, several other birds had come over to see what the wren and the eagle were talking about. They agreed that having a contest sounded like great fun. They all launched themselves into the air and began flapping upwards as hard as they could. The pigeon was buffeted by the wind and soon gave up. Next to go was the yellow-headed gannet. "I'm good at diving, not soaring," she complained as she plunged back toward the sea. The seagull rose higher and higher on the wind, but then a shadow fell across him. "It's a pity you don't have wings as long as mine," cawed the albatross boastfully. The gull shrieked in frustration as she gave up and glided back down to the ground. Meanwhile, the eagle was pumping his mighty wings and climbing high into the sky. Even the albatross could not keep up with him and flew away. The eagle was now so high that the air was thin. His wings were so tired that he couldn't flap any longer, but he had left his rivals far below. "I've proven that I'm better than that pitiful little wren," he muttered to himself. "I don't know about that," chirped a high voice from behind him. The wren had stowed away on the eagle's back. She launched herself upwards and began flapping her little wings furiously. The eagle tried to climb higher, but he was exhausted. He gave up and glided down on the wind. When the wren fluttered back to the cliff top, the other birds declared that she was their queen. Though the wren was only small, her cleverness had helped her to climb higher than the rest, proving that she would make a good ruler. The next story is a Worlds of Wonder story called My Zen Friend. Kim packed carefully for his journey. His rucksack was filled with everything he could possibly need, including a packed lunch and water to stay hydrated. He had snack bars in his pockets, as well as a pair of woolly gloves. It was the middle of the summer, but he would be glad to have them if a freak blizzard struck. "Don't forget your hat," his mom told him as he was lacing up his boots. He put it on and tightened the drawstring under his chin. "Do you really need this vest, though?" she asked. "Better safe than sorry," he told her in a serious voice. With that, the boys set off into the forest. Dewdrops still rested on the leaves of the palm trees, and small birds fluttered from branch to branch. The trail got rougher as he went downhill. Tree roots tried to snag his feet, and it became darker as tall trees blocked out the sunlight. Other kids might be scared if they were in the jungle, but not brave Kim the Explorer. A tree branch snapped. Kim froze and peered into the bushes. Was that a large, shadowy figure hiding back there? "Don't come any closer," he said loudly. His voice hardly trembled at all. "I've got a big friend watching out for me." There was a low growl from behind him. It was his best friend in the whole world, Echo the Panda. The shadowy figure in the bushes disappeared as quickly as it had come. Kim turned around and greeted his huge, shaggy-furred friend. "Thanks for the backup, Echo, but I wasn't scared, really." The bear rumbled deep in his throat as he chewed on a bamboo shoot. "Nobody is going to cause trouble when I'm around," he said. Echo let Kim ride on his back as they traveled down the path. It was fun, although the boy had to hold on tight so he didn't slip off the beast's furry back. When they came to a rocky gorge with a stream at the bottom, Kim grabbed a vine and swung across, landing neatly on the other side. Echo just jumped over it. The path led them to the banks of a river that flowed swiftly through the forest. Echo dipped a paw into the water and grimaced. "The most courageous thing a person can do is admit that they are afraid," he rumbled. "I'm definitely afraid of getting wet." Kim felt like laughing, but he kept a straight face. "Don't worry, I'll do the paddling for both of us." He pulled an inflatable boat and an oar from the bushes and told the big bear to climb aboard. The craft rode very low in the water with Echo on it. When everything was ready, Kim pushed off and they were carried downstream by the current. The boy paddled into the middle of the river, where the warm morning sun shone down on them. Echo relaxed and enjoyed the ride. Ahead was a little concrete jetty. Kim paddled strongly to get them over to it and held the rubber boat steady so Echo could safely scramble ashore. The boy peered at his digital watch. "Oh no, it's almost 8 o'clock. We'll have to climb up this cliff to make it in time." Echo nodded wisely. "If we do, we should fasten a rope between us. Together, we are stronger." Kim agreed. He tied a rope from his pack around their waists and they began climbing up the rocky slope. Echo was right. It was a lot easier and safer when they worked together. They helped each other to climb up to the top of the gorge. There was one last obstacle, the bridge. It stretched across a forested valley, its metal wires twanging in the wind. This was the bit that made Kim nervous. As he stepped onto the bridge's deck, it began to bounce and shake from side to side. Did he have to go across? He felt a big paw on his shoulder. "Don't worry, my little friend," Echo rumbled. "You're the bravest boy I know. You just need to trust in yourself and find your courage." Kim smiled and nodded, though his knees felt as if they were turning to water. He took one step after another across the bridge. He glanced down and saw birds flying below through the gaps in the deck. After what seemed like forever, Kim finally got his feet back on solid ground. He glanced at his watch. It was 7:57. Echo looked at him. "This has been fun, my friend, but very tiring." Kim put his bag on the ground and unzipped it. Echo had shrunk down in size. The bear clambered in and said, "I think I'll have a nap while you are learning things. See you at home time." With that, he zipped up the bag and began to snore. Kim ran into the classroom just as the bell was ringing. He sat down next to his friend Eve. "How was your walk to school?" she asked. Kim gave her a little grin. "Oh, the same as usual. Many kids in remote areas around the globe have to go on real adventures to get to school." why not have a discussion about the challenges that children who live in thick jungles or on mountains or distant islands might face when getting to class? Our next story is an awesome adventure called The Girl Who Grew. On the 1st of April in 1940, a baby girl was born in the little village of Ahithi in Kenya. She was named Wangari after one of her legendary ancestors. Wangari's parents were of the Kikuyu people, who had lived in the green highlands of Kenya for longer than anyone could remember. One day, her mother pointed at a nearby peak that pierced the clouds. That is Mount Kenya, the tallest mountain in the country. Our stories say that is where God lives. He gifted us with this land and makes sure that it is watered by the rains in the right season so our crops will grow and give us food. The land that their people farmed did seem to be blessed. They kept goats, cows, and sheep, grew maize, wheat, and vegetables in the rich red-brown soil, and gathered nuts and berries in the forest. Nobody was ever thirsty because clean, fresh water fell from the sky and flowed in the streams. Little Wangari soon became familiar with the passing seasons. In mid-March, the monsoon rains would fall. July was so foggy that in the morning you could not see 10 paces in front of you, and the grass was covered in frost. Sometimes it got so cold, the birds would freeze and fall from the trees. Wangari was the eldest daughter in her family and helped to care for her brothers. Her mom was impressed by how responsible the girl was and said she could start her very own garden. "Don't stay inside when it rains," she would tell Wangari. "That's the best time to plant things." So Wangari put beans and maize and millet seeds in the soil when the weather was wet. They soon sprouted and sent out shoots. The girl still had to help out around the house, of course. For example, she went into the forest to cut wood for the fire each evening. "But don't take the wood from the wild fig trees," her mother would say. "They bless the land." This puzzled Wangari. Years later, she learned that the fig tree's roots reached down to water deep in the earth and let it bubble to the surface so the plants nearby would flourish. Then she understood how wise her mother really was. At that time, Kenya was ruled by people from a distant land called Great Britain. They told the people of Kenya what they could and couldn't do and made them pay money called taxes for living in their empire. Settlers from Britain took much of the best land, and Kenyans had to go and work for them to earn money. But the British also built schools where Kenyan children could learn many things. Her brother and cousin went to one nearby. One day, Wangari's brother asked their mother a question that changed the girl's life forever. "Why doesn't Wangari go to school like I do?" This made her mom stop and think. Why shouldn't her clever daughter get an education? That was how Wangari found herself walking barefoot down the muddy path to the primary school. She had a school bag and a pencil and a slate and an exercise book. She was anxious and excited and had no idea what to expect. Her cousin Jono went to the same school and volunteered to take her. "Can you read?" he asked. "No," she admitted. "Then can you write?" Wangari wasn't sure what writing was and said so. "I'll show you writing," said Jono. He took out a piece of paper and licked his pencil before drawing some squiggly symbols. Wangari couldn't understand what they meant, but she was impressed. "Now I'll show you the amazing bit," said Jono. He wiped at the paper with a rubber, and the squiggles disappeared as if they were never there. "This is the kind of wonderful thing you will learn at school," he boasted. This made Wangari excited. Think of all the things she would discover. The school was a simple building with a tin roof, mud walls, and an earth floor. In winter, the kids had to warm their hands in front of the fire before they could write. Wangari did not mind, though. She absorbed all the knowledge she could. She learned to count and read and write and rub things out, of course. But then things got really interesting. She was taught math and geography and English, the language of the British Empire. Wangari loved learning and did very well. She was even invited to go to Kenya's best girls' high school near Nairobi, the country's capital. One of the nuns that taught there noticed how interested Wangari was in plants and other living things. The girl would stay after school to help the nun clean laboratory equipment and get extra lessons. Learning more about plants gave her a deeper understanding of the things her mother had taught her. When Wangari's schooling came to an end, everybody wondered what she would do next. "Will you become a teacher? Or a nurse?" they would ask. At that time, those were the only jobs an educated woman was supposed to do. But Wangari had other ideas. "Oh no," she would answer. "I'm going to university." In 1963, the Kenyans decided that they didn't want to be part of the British Empire anymore. Kenya became an independent nation, and it needed clever people to run things, people like Wangari. The brightest young people in Kenya were invited to study at top universities in the United States, where they could acquire more knowledge and meet people from other parts of the world. Wangari had finished at the top of her class in high school, so she was one of the 300 Kenyans who were offered a chance to study in America. This was terribly exciting. As Wangari prepared for her great journey across the ocean, she thought back to what her mother had taught her about the fig tree. Just as the tree's roots tapped into fresh underground water, she would tap into the knowledge she would find in America and bring it back to Kenya. By doing this, she would help her beloved country to grow and flourish. What happened next? Wangari Maathai earned a bachelor's degree in science and a master's degree in biology from the University of Pittsburgh in the United States. She also received a doctorate from the University of Nairobi and was the first woman in Eastern and Central Africa to earn this degree. Wangari became an activist, fighting for justice and equality in Kenya. She also started an organization called the Green Belt Movement. This group, made up mostly of women, planted trees and worked to restore forests while protesting against government corruption and fighting for free and fair elections. The Kenyan government did not like this and did its best to bully her and suppress the Green Belt Movement. She was even arrested in 2001. However, Wangari was elected to the Kenyan Parliament in 2002 and received a Nobel Peace Prize for her work for sustainable development, democracy, and peace in 2004. And our next story is an around-the-world tale called The Stonemason's Sons. Once upon a time, on the banks of the River Nile, there lived a pharaoh who was the richest man in the world. He had incredible wealth, but it did not make him happy. The ruler spent all his time worrying that somebody would rob him. "What is the good of having piles of gold and silver and precious stones if I cannot protect them?" he complained. Suddenly, he had a brilliant idea. "I need to build a treasure room that nobody can break into," he decided. "Then I will finally be able to relax." He called for a stonemason and said, "Build a great vault in my palace to hold my treasure. It must be so strong that nobody can get into it." The craftsman was poor and he was happy to have more work. "I will, Your Majesty," he said. "May I ask how much you will pay me for this job?" The Pharaoh was as miserly as he was wealthy, so he replied, I will pay one deben and no more. The stonemason felt a bit upset. This job would take him many months, and one deben would barely be enough to buy barley bread for his family for a week. However, he agreed to do it. He spent months cutting blocks of stone and using them to build the treasure room. It was very strong, just as the Pharaoh had wanted. However, the stonemason secretly made a stone block that would move to the side if pushed. When the room was finished, the Pharaoh was pleased. He put his precious things inside and visited often to count his wealth. The stonemason was paid one ring-shaped deben coin, but he soon ran out of money and could not afford to feed his wife and two sons. He decided to tell his boys about the secret stone block in the Pharaoh's treasure room. You will find it marked with the symbol of an ibis, he whispered. If you push on it, it will move aside so you can sneak into the Pharaoh's vault and borrow a few coins. It is wrong to steal, but we need the money to pay for food. That night, his sons crept up to the wall of the palace and waited until the guards had gone past. They spotted the marked stone and pushed it, revealing a gap. The boys wriggled through the hole and found themselves in the vault. It was filled with coins and jewels and statues made of pure gold. Let's grab everything we can carry, said one boy. No, we must be careful, hissed the other. Only take what we need. He grabbed 5 debens before wriggling out again with his brother. The boys hoped that the Pharaoh would not notice that they had stolen a few coins, but the ruler kept careful count of his riches. When he added up the money in his vault the following morning, he knew something was wrong. I am 5 debens short, he yelled. Guards, you must grab the thief when he tries to steal again. After a month, the stonemason's family ran out of money again, so his sons went back to the vault. The first one pressed on the stone and wriggled through the gap. He was quickly grabbed by the guards who were waiting inside. I've been caught, the boy yelled to his brother. Save yourself. The younger sibling ran away as fast as he could. The older brother was brought before the Pharaoh. Here is the thief, said the head guard. I think he had a friend, too. He yelled out to him. The Pharaoh stroked his beard. Is that so? You must tell us who you are and how we can find your partner in crime. The boy refused to answer, but the Pharaoh just chuckled. Since you are so stubborn, I will find another way to capture your friend. I'll leave you tied up outside, and when he tries to rescue you, we'll grab him too. That was how the poor boy found himself in front of the palace, guarded by burly soldiers. When night fell, the plaza outside the palace was silent. Then the guards heard a clop, clop, clop sound. A merchant in a big cloak was leading a donkey down the road. The animal was weighed down with heavy objects that clanked as it walked. What are you doing here? Asked one of the guards suspiciously. Oh, I'm just a humble trader with a load of wine jars, the merchant replied in a muffled voice. Your jars are leaking, a guard laughed. This was true. A dark liquid was dripping onto the ground. Don't worry, we won't let it go to waste, the guards said as they used cups to catch the wine and gulp it down. They drank so much, they soon fell asleep. The trader then threw off his cloak. It was the mason's youngest son. I'm here to rescue you, he told his brother as he cut the ropes that bound him. The two of them escaped into the darkness. The Pharaoh was angry at his guards for letting the thieves escape, but he was impressed by the boy's clever plan. I could use intelligent lads like them to help me rule Egypt, he thought. If I pay them fairly, they won't need to steal either. He told his messengers to read a special proclamation. I, the Pharaoh of the upper and lower kingdoms of Egypt, hereby pardon the two thieves who stole from my treasure room. You are very ingenious, and I want to employ you as my advisors." The brothers accepted the Pharaoh's offer and became his new ministers. They advised him to pay his workers fairly, as this would make all of Egypt happy and prosperous. The Pharaoh did as they said, for he had learned his lesson. And our last story of the day is called Short Stories, Big Dreams. The Emperor's Old Clothes. The emperor's birthday was coming up, and he was celebrating with a big party. He had the grand ballroom decorated and told his chefs to prepare a generous feast. The emperor was very vain, so his biggest decision was what to wear. "Summon the finest designers," he declared. "I want the most fabulous outfit of all, but make sure that the clothes can actually be seen." A year ago, he had learned his lesson when two swindlers had convinced him to wear an outfit that didn't actually exist. Luckily, one boy was brave enough to point out that he was naked. Since then, the ruler made sure the things he bought were real. Three fashion designers soon arrived to show him their wares. "Look at this ruffled robe in green silk, trimmed with jewels from Bohemia. You will look exquisite," said the seamstress from the distant nation of Dinar. "This vest combines puffy sleeves with a bold diamond pattern. Very stylish. This look will set a trend, trust me," gushed the designer from the land of Sterling. "For a classic look, you can't beat this fancy tweed jacket adorned with delicate chains and accessories," claimed the pompous tailor from the icy shores of Krona. "They are so extravagant, exactly what I had in mind," the emperor decided. "I shall have all three." Just then the door opened with a bang. In walked a boy in a velvet coat that dragged along the ground. It was the kid who had once pointed out that the emperor had no clothes. The ruler had made him his chief minister because he always told the truth. "Why buy new outfits?" the boy asked. "You have wardrobes full of clothes." "But what will my subjects say?" the emperor protested. "They will think I am short of money." The boy waved his hand. "Outfit repeating is a hot trend right now, trust me." He went through the emperor's wardrobe and quickly found some amazing clothes that the ruler had forgotten about. A local seamstress made a few adjustments and added a silk sash from an old cape. The party was a hit. The music and food were amazing, but the emperor's old clothes caused the most gossip. He received lots of compliments from his guests. The emperor had to admit that the boy was right again. His old clothes were better than the new ones. It was all about how you wore them. At the end of the evening, he admired himself in the mirror and thought, "Perhaps I shall be known as the emperor who wore vintage from now on." And that will wrap it up for now. This has been Mary Beth Gianni with Storytime Magazine. Thanks as always for listening, and have a great day.